I'm Jenny Williamson Duray, board member of Wappan, and one of the owners of Fox and Wyman in Santa Barbara. But I have the distinct pleasure and honor. It's how many years we've been doing this, Alan?
Six now, I think.
Is it the sixth year?
I think.
To introduce Alan Geddes, who in many ways needs no introductions, but I will just give you a little bit of a history here. Alan Geddes, who founded Birdhound in 2000, the same year that Wappan was conceived, so I think there's some symmetry there.
Gotta be.
For those of you who don't know, was a very successful financials executive for 25 years. And actually, in the state of the world right now, I think your choice was...
just in time.
Alan retired in 1999, and as I mentioned earlier, Birdhound was born in 2000. Your first issue was January of 2001.
You are remarkably well informed.
I've not done this before, but nonetheless. So those who don't know, it's a quarterly review viewed by readers in more than 45 countries. And Alan has one of the world's best job. Gets to spend 4 months a year visiting over 300 domains in Burgundy. And now his review features U.S. Pinot Noirs, which of course we are very grateful for. So in any case, without further ado, I want to, before I turn it over to Alan here to make his introductions, just a little housekeeping. And I won't be here at the end, I need to run over to the Iron Song seminar this morning. But we're going to wrap up here about noon, in which case then we're going to go directly upstairs, actually up the stairs into the next building where lunch will be served at 12:15 at Marisol. So without further ado, I just would like to turn it over to Alan and thank you very much. And I'm so sorry I can't taste today and to enjoy. So anyway, enjoy.
Thank you, Jenny. Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Always great to see so many faces that over the years don't seem to change too much. But for those that's a good thing. It's a good thing. For those that haven't been here before, welcome. We try and basically do this for you. So rather than holding all the questions until the end, just feel free to raise your hand whenever. I have the distinct pleasure to share the dais this morning with Pierre Gouges. Domaine Gouges, as I will explain in some detail, is one of the true historical domains in Burgundy. I will explain more as well on exactly why, but this domain is as responsible as any, which is a fairly dramatic statement when you think about it. Is as responsible as any in Burgundy for making it what it is today. That's no small statement. We'll explain more later. One housekeeping item, please turn off your cell phones. The second thing is that Flight 1, we made an executive decision a bit ago and decided to serve Flight 1 at the end. So we'll be starting with Flight 2. One other thing, through a small miscommunication, is that Wine K got served early. And so I would encourage all of you to go ahead and take a look at Wine K now. We'll come back to it at the very end, but because it's now knocking on the door of being 40 years of age, we think it's probably best that you go ahead and look at it now, because over the next 2 hours, it will probably evolve. And if you wait, you may miss something. It was, by the way, never moved. It was bottled, put in the cave, and hasn't been touched since. So this has not been reconditioned. It has not been reworked. So it is as original as it can be, because it never moved. So with that, I'd like to introduce Pierre Gouge, who is one of the two owners of Domaine Henri Gouge, who was Pierre's grandfather. And so Pierre would like to make a small statement, and then I'll take over, give a small introduction, and we're going to do a little ham and egg this morning. So, Pierre.
Good morning. I'm very happy and honored to be here this morning. This is such a great event, and I am happy to see so many people so interested in Pinot from Domaine Henri Gouge. But my English is limited, so I will continue it in French.
Excuse me. succinctly put.
Okay.
So, why is Domaine Henri Gouge so important? Well, it's due to Henri Gouge himself, who was, as the French say, un vrai personnage. He was quite a personality, a very strong, dominant person. And let me set the stage. I'm big on context these days, because I think it's difficult to understand the nuance without some context to put it in. Burgundy has changed a great deal, in spite of the fact that you can take its roots back at least 2,000 years. There are some who feel it can go back much further. But if we skip basically 1,850 years, we arrive at a moment of phylloxera. Phylloxera arrived in Burgundy in 1878. And phylloxera, probably everyone in the room knows what it is, but in case someone doesn't, it is a small insect that is capable of destroying vines, killing them, because certain rootstocks, and the rootstocks that were present in Burgundy during that period, would be attacked. It would leave a wound that wouldn't heal, and eventually the vines would die. There was a solution. They grafted European varieties onto American rootstock, which solved the problem, at least on the surface. But the first vintage of surgreffage, where they actually grafted these vines onto American rootstock, was 1893. So you had a bunch of dramatic things happen. One, they had this whole system of viticulture called provignage, of which was what we would call en foule. And the hectare, and for those of you that may not remember your grade school conversions, a hectare is 2.5 acres. They had roughly 24 to 30,000 vines per hectare. In today's system, it runs 10 to 12,000. So the density was 2 to 2.5 times greater. You had young vines with a very different rootstock. And as a consequence, there was an explosion of production. The wine wasn't very good, but even with that, there were a lot of vineyards that were not replanted due to the expense. What happened? Well, the big merchants ruled Burgundy. So the big negotiant houses held sway, because in the 1800s, the number of domains that were actually domain bottling, you can count on these fingers. Difficult to imagine, because we think of Bordeaux as being an ancient region as well, and estate bottling there was at least more typical. There were plenty of English merchants that bottled as well. But the point is that the large merchants ruled. And what did they do when there was no wine in Burgundy? They had the same clients with the same thirst, with the same desire for the wines of Burgundy. These merchants weren't stupid. They imported wine, relabeled it under the prestigious names of Burgundy, and sold it. Well, that was great for them. But for the small grower who barely had enough money to replant, and once they did replant, couldn't get reasonable returns on that production because of the importation of wine from the south of France. And What ultimately happened was more of them were driven out of business. The land was available for very little, the merchants had money, and they started to buy up. They started to become hybrids, which is what most of negociants are in Burgundy today, which are hybrids. They buy in wine, but they also are domains in their own right. Well, why does any of this matter? Well, because so much fraud caused so much problem, and at that period of time in France, one person in seven derived their income from wine in some fashion. It became a dramatic problem. And little by little, there were calls to establish a system that would protect the identity, the authenticity of the wine in question. Well, as you might imagine, the people that had the power didn't have any interest in this system at all, because it would limit what they could do. It would make it a criminal offense for them to relabel something that was not Richebourg as Richebourg. Well, it caused riots. There were bruising battles. Those that were favored in a tiny village, and you can just imagine the social politics in a village of 150 people, where some wanted to sell to the negotiants and others were stubborn and said, no, we will always be effectively slaves, economic slaves, if we continue to do this. So a movement was started to create what ultimately became the AOC system, the Appellation d'Origine Contrôlée, which is the basis of all French viticulture today. And in fact, much of the world has adopted this system. Even here in the US, we have our AVAs, which are essentially a form of the AOC. Well, this, as I mentioned, was an extremely, extremely difficult time. And think of the crisis, the crash, of which we're reminded of in the newspaper every day today in 1929. Well, this exacerbated, as did Prohibition, by the way, this exacerbated a situation where the growers in Burgundy couldn't get paid for what they were producing. So someone by the name of Henri Gouges decided there is a way out of this, but it's up to us, the small grower, to do something about it. And what was that solution? Well, that solution was to begin to bottle the wine himself and develop a network of private clients that would pay him a reasonable return for what he wanted to do. And in the meantime, he battled for the establishment of a fair AOC system. And it was people like Henri Gouges, who was allied with the Marquis d'Angerville in the Côte d'Ivoire, and the two of them essentially led the fight against the large negociants. Well, the negociants didn't take this lying down. They essentially blackballed anybody who said that they were going to do the mise themselves. And so they refused to buy from these people, putting even more economic pressure. Thankfully, people like Henri Gouges and Marquis d'Angerville were sufficiently well off that they could at least tolerate the fact that they couldn't sell all of their wine right away. And little by little, this encouraged others. In my database, I have something like 42,000 Burgundies in it that go back to 1845. And just to take a look at all this research that I had done, I ran a quick search that said, show me everything I've tasted before 1950. And there were, I don't know, roughly 900 and some odd wines. It is fascinating to think that in 1950, there were a total that I have tasted of 14 domains that were estate bottling at that time. That is a remarkable statement when you think about it. And all of the rest were negociant bottled. So that gives you a sense as to why Henri Gouges and the domain has a place in history that is unlike almost any other in Burgundy. So it is due to Pierre's grandfather that Burgundy is the way it is today. And just to fast forward through the story, it was 1973, which again is very, very recent. It's actually after one of the wines on the table in front of us was bottled. It was the oil crisis, the petrol crisis in 1973, that provoked again the negotiants to stop buying. Now, this wasn't so much an effort to persuade through economic difficulty. It was that economic difficulty was forced on the negotiants. Lots of wine wasn't all that good at that time due to potassium being in the soil and a variety of things. However, it provoked others to finally follow the model established by those like Rumier, like de Vogüé, like DRC, like d'Angerville, like Gouge, others that I could name. But there were still very, very few, even only 40 years ago. And it wasn't until the 1980s when the movement to domain bottling really blossomed. And so we think of Burgundy as being an extremely ancient region, and it is. But in terms of what they call the mise, bottling being done at the property itself, it is a modern phenomenon. So just a little history as to why Henri Gouge and the domain is held in the esteem that it is. It wouldn't be held in the esteem, however, if it didn't make excellent wine as well. And so that is what Pierre and I are up here for, is to give you some context as to what the domain does, how it does it, to teach you a bit about the terroirs that they work with. I'm going to take just two more minutes to give you an introduction to Neuilly-Saint-Georges, and then I'm going to turn it over to Pierre to introduce his wines, tell you about the domain itself, and we can as well take any questions that you might have. Very quickly, Neuilly-Saint-Georges, when it was up for review, like all the communes in Burgundy in the 20s and very early 30s, Henri Gouge, among other things, was also the leader in Neuilly-Saint-Georges for the classification system. Each commune appointed one or two people to recommend the vines, the vineyards that would have the various classifications in the hierarchy, which I think probably everybody knows, but just in case, there are four levels in the hierarchy, which are the regional wines, Bourgogne, the village wines, such as Neuilly-Saint-Georges, Premier Cru, and Grand Cru. A lot of people have questioned over the years, why doesn't Neuilly-Saint-Georges have a Grand Cru? All the other communes in the Côte de Nuits, with the exception of Marcenais and Fissin, have Grand Crus. And especially when you have vineyards like Les Saint-Georges, Vaucrin, L'Écaille, Boudot, there are any number of candidates that could have been at least reasonably considered. Well, the argument is that Henri Gouge was so concerned about the notion that there was a conflict of interest involved in anything that he might do, and the domain held a big chunk of Les Saint-Georges, that he never proposed it. And people to this day debate whether Les Saint-Georges should be a Grand Cru or not. There is a reasonable argument, I think, because we've had this discussion before, for those of you that have attended prior seminars. We've talked about, should Clos Saint-Jacques, Amoureuse, Cros-Parentoux, Les Saint-Georges, should they be Grand Crus? There's an argument. You can argue either side of it, but those are four vineyards in the Côte de Nuits producing red wine that are consistently cited again and again and again. That is not an accident. So there are people who genuinely believe that they are at least as good as Échezeaux, as lower level Clos Vougeot. The argument is there to be made. One of the things that happened, though, in partial compensation of the fact that there were no Grand Crus named, is that Neuilly-Saint-Georges has by far and away the most land devoted to Premier Cru in the Côte de Nuits. It dwarfs everything else. And so the critics of the system, and there's always someone who thinks that it should have been this way or that way, in other words, sort of second-guessing the Iowa State system and the classification. There are those who say that the founders of the system were too generous in Nuit-Saint-Georges. And coincidentally, there are those who say the same thing about Bone. Why would I say anything about Bone? Well, there are two centers where the big negotiants held sway. And those were, and are today, Bone and Nuit-Saint-Georges. And ironically enough, all this time I talked about the interest of the small grower and the interest of the grand négociant being counter to one another. Well, as soon as the big negotiants realized that standing in front of a tidal wave wasn't a good place to be, they ultimately said, okay, if there's going to be an Iowa State system, then why not try and influence the outcome? And so there's a reason that when you look at the Côte du Bone, Bone has more permacrew than any other commune, and I think there's a reason as well in Nuit-Saint-Georges that it has 145 hectares, 147 to be precise, of permacrew. I don't think that's an accident either. But when you look at it, there aren't very many that you would say, yeah, they're just all right. So with that, why don't I turn it over to Pierre, let him present the domain to you. We'll talk about the terroirs. There is lots and lots of good stuff that we have prepared for you. And as I said before, let me encourage you one last time, don't be shy. This is for you. So, sir.
Well, can you explain why the AOC system doesn't periodically, maybe every 25, 30, 50 years, reclassify, you know, look at their decisions and make new ones?
Did everyone hear the question? Okay, because I'm happy to repeat it if not. Well, actually they do. And every 21 years, there is, in fact, a reconciliation of various proposals that have been made. And the system is not static. There are changes from time to time. In fact, there was one in Prémaux not too long ago, and we'll talk about how Nuit-Saint-Georges is organized, but Prémaux, which is a small commune just to the south, actually has the right to Nuit-Saint-Georges in both village and permacrew, and there was some Bourgogne that actually was kicked up to permacrew. In Vaune, for example, au-dessus de Malcansor was a village in 88, it got kicked up to permacrew. You can, for example, in 1979, Claude Lambray became a Grand Cru. In 1992, Le Grand Roux, sandwiched between Romanée-Conti and La Tâche, pretty high rent dirt, was elevated to Grand Cru. But the INAO, which is the Institut National that basically governs all things vinous in France, rarely giveth without taking away. And usually when a commune says, well, we want these vineyards to be upgraded, usually there's a cost in that certain village level vineyards are pushed down to Bourgogne. So that the total amount of AOC village in that particular village doesn't change very much, even though the actual mixture may. So it's not static. Things do change. In some communes, not very much changes. And Grand Crus, ever since they established the system in 1935, there have been a whopping two. There have been any number of applications. For example, there is one outstanding at the moment in Pommard to have Rougienne and Epineau upgraded to Grand Cru. There is at least some chance that that will pass, because much like Nuit-Saint-Georges, there are those who believe that Pommard was overlooked. There's arguments on both sides. So.
Has a Grand Cru ever been downgraded to Premier Cru?
No. Pierre notes as well that Merceau, especially for Perrières, has done that. Albert Griveaux, the domain, who owns the Clos des Barrières, has a dossier that's more than 20 years of age now. They haven't gotten anywhere with it, and I'm not sure they're going to get anywhere with that one, but people try all the time, because there's a real economic incentive to do that. Okay. Yeah.
Au sujet de ce grand feu.
Ah non, mais continue à présenter le domaine.
Oui, si on veut présenter le domaine, donc le domaine, c'est moi, je suis de la troisième génération, il y a la quatrième qui suit.
Okay, so Pierre is the third generation, and it is his son Grégoire who will be the fourth generation to lead the domaine.
Donc uniquement appellation du Saint-Georges et sur 15 hectares.
So they have 15 hectares, and it's all in Nuits-Saint-Georges. And in fact, except if you look at your map, it's very the very end of your package, except for a tiny piece of Chaigneau, it is all in the middle section of Nuits-Saint-Georges. So basically 14 and a half of the 15 hectares are in the middle section of Nuits.
Avec, c'est vrai, des sols quand même un peu différents côté nord et côté sud. On pense que les vrais du Saint-Georges, très typés, seraient plutôt au sud, alors que les vins du nord seraient plutôt quand même typés vos Normanais.
Okay. So, he's explaining that among the three sectors of Nuits-Saint-Georges, and they call the northern section the section Vaunois, because it obviously abuts Vaux Romanais. Other than that small section, the vineyards are all in the middle, as I noted, and Pierre underlines or emphasizes that this gives what is viewed by most people as le vrai, the true, Nuits-Saint-Georges. In other words, the archetype, if you will, of Nuits comes from this section.
Donc la majorité des parcelles ont été achetées par Henri Gouges au moment des crises économiques, c'est-à-dire entre les deux guerres.
So most of the domain was built up by Henri Gouges, who had 9 of the 15 hectares, and he assembled this basically in the 20s and 30s due to the economic crisis, which enabled him to buy from neighbors who either wanted to sell out or were having difficulty and needed the money.
Donc quelques parcelles ont été rajoutées après la guerre pour arriver à 15 hectares.
Quelle guerre?
La deuxième.
Deuxième guerre. Okay. A few parcels were added after the Second World War, but basically the domain is where it is, or is, in terms of its size, has been at this level for a long time now.
Donc un domaine qui travaille sur les mêmes terres depuis quand même pas mal d'années, qui n'a pas beaucoup évolué en surface.
Basically saying that it hasn't changed any in a long, long time.
Donc la majorité des vignes sont quand même assez âgées, puisqu'il y en a certaines qui sont toujours plantées comme elles ont été achetées.
Ah bon.
Ouais, alors, il y a des vignes qui ont encore 70-80 ans.
So the domain also, in many cases, the vineyards are planted on the same or to the same vines that they were when the vineyard was purchased, which means that the average age is extremely high. And in many cases, runs between 70 and 80 years of age.
Donc, on a quand même, à partir des années 70, commencé de renouveler le domaine, parce qu'il y avait une partie qui était quand même très âgée. Donc, c'est vrai qu'il y a eu une période où on a travaillé un peu plus sur des jeunes vignes, mais aujourd'hui, la moyenne d'âge des vignes dans le domaine, ça doit être autour de 50 ans.
So, in 1970, thereabouts, because so many of the vines started to become economically unviable because they became too old, either because they wouldn't produce or through disease, they started a system of slowly replanting things. And par repiquage?
Non, on a, oui, on a repiquage, oui, mais quand même quelquefois arraché complètement.
Okay, so there are two systems in Burgundy in terms of replantation. I mean, it's an oversimplification, but basically there are two systems. One is where you just completely pull up something, and another is where you replant vine by vine. That's called repiquage. And it There's no free lunch in life. There's always some price to be paid. It's much, much more efficient and much cheaper to come in and rip things up because you can do it mechanically. And you can replant all at once, so your nurseryman, called a pépiniériste, in Burgundy can supply a quantity, and so it's much more efficient. The only problem is that you're left with a vineyard that has nothing but young vines. Repicage is vine by vine, and that is wonderful because it leaves you with a healthy proportion of older vines. The only problem is it's very expensive to do. And in this case, Pierre explains that they use both systems depending on the vineyard, depending on the plant material, because in certain cases, don't forget, there was a lot of, as I explained at the beginning, there was a lot of experimentation that was being done. And just because something was replanted doesn't mean that it was replanted to high quality rootstock. And so sometimes they decide, even though the vines are still viable, they decide to rip out everything because they don't like the quality of fruit that it gives. So just because a vine is old doesn't mean that it's giving you high quality fruit.
Donc ces replantations ont été faites pendant beaucoup d'années avec toujours la vieille sélection du domaine, des greffes qui étaient reprises sur les anciennes vignes. Mm-hmm. Et puis au bout, quand on a commencé à avoir des clones intéressants, on a essayé les clones. Mm-hmm.
So what they've done is basically a field selection out of the original plantation that they had. So it's called a sélection massale. And what they do is simply by observation, they look at the vines that give them the highest quality fruit. They take cuttings from those, they propagate them, and that's what they use to replant their vineyards. And so they basically self-source all their replanting material. I neglected to mention that after all this was done, today, average across all their vines is 50 years of age.
Donc aujourd'hui le domaine est cultivé en organique.
So they follow an organic cultivation policy.
Avec donc un retour depuis peut-être 10 ans, un peu plus, au labour.
So for the last 10 years, they plow. And that is something that not everyone does. It is seen more and more in Burgundy now, but for a long time, it was much, much cheaper to use herbicides, weed killers, and the like to control growth between the rows. It was justified in many cases as controlling erosion, because if the dirt is hard-packed, then it has less tendency to run off. The only problem is that if the guy below you plows and the person above you does not, all that water comes rushing down off the hill and at a much higher velocity and tends to exacerbate the erosion in your vineyard. The other thing that people have now reflected on is that if you have hard-packed soil, the microbial life there is very, very difficult to encourage and sustain. And more people believe that an active microflora and fauna population in the dirt, in your vines, is highly, highly important. And that's one reason why people have gone to much lighter tractors. But it can be dicey, because you have to remember that most of the very best vineyards in Burgundy are relatively sloped. And tractors are hard to use. You might, for those of you that have been to Burgundy, and you look up and you see fairly steep vineyards, and you might say, well, why are they planted east-west, meaning consistent with the slope? And you say to yourself, wouldn't it make more sense to go the other way? And it would if you were willing to use a horse, but if you're in a tractor sitting now parallel to the slope, that's not much fun. I can get exciting quick.
Et donc, pour ces problèmes d'érosion sur le domaine, pratiquement toutes les parcelles qui sont en pente un peu forte sont en cultivées en enherbement permanent. Mm-hmm.
And it was Pierre's idea, in fact, he was one of the pioneers of this idea in Burgundy, to actually plant ryegrass and other grasses in between the rows so that they could plow but have an active plant material that was pushing down roots and would keep the soil from compacting.
L'enherbement, je pense que autant c'est facile dans des vignes qui sont plantées très larges, autant ça pose des gros problèmes techniques dans des vignes comme en Bourgogne, on est planté à un cep par mètre carré, sur une largeur d'un mètre, et il y a beaucoup de concurrence, il faut trouver les outils techniques pour entretenir qui n'existaient pas, donc ça a été très compliqué au départ.
He's saying that while he very much likes the results today, when they first started, it was extremely complicated to manage. A little math for you to help illustrate the issue. 1 hectare has 100 ars in it. 100 ars has 100 centiars, hence the name. So what that means is that there are 10,000 square meters in a hectare. And in Burgundy, the typical spacing is meter by meter. So 1 square meter, 1 vaan. But if you think about 3 feet, basically, 39 inches, as the distance between, when you start planting ryegrass or other grasses between, in rows that are that tightly spaced, then there isn't much room to get your tractor through there, hence the funny look of the what they call the enjambeurs, which is literally a tractor that sits very high, but it's narrow. And they're saying that they fall over pretty easily because they have a very high center of gravity, which again, as someone who helped my grandparents, both sides of the family, running a farm when I was a teenager, I've actually had one fall over, and I'm not kidding when I say that it's exciting. Can't even say it's exciting. But one of the things that ryegrass does is to help control erosion, but it also has lots and lots of competition implications for the vines. And one of the things that it causes the vine to do is that if it can't find what it wants at the surface, then the roots have to dig deep to find water and other nutrients. And if you introduce this all at once, you can actually kill vines because they don't have the developed root system. And so there's lots, like I said, there's no free lunch. You pay now, you pay later, but you pay. And introducing this all at once wasn't easy until the vines adapted and the domain learned how to better control things. Also, not all vineyards, either because of age, because of slope, because of water retention characteristics, not all vineyards react the same way to having what is, in essence, another form of competition being introduced.
Donc aujourd'hui, cet enherbement nous va très bien par rapport à l'érosion, mais en plus on s'est aperçu qu'on avait un très bon équilibre biologique, une vie microbienne très active et des sols qui fonctionnent très bien. Ce qui nous amène à des choses un peu plus tranchées au niveau des terroirs, c'est-à-dire que les terroirs sont plus marqués les uns par rapport aux autres qu'à une époque où on était avec d'autres façons culturelles.
He's saying that he's extremely happy with the results because one of the things that they have noticed over the 30-some-odd years that they've been doing this is that they get better expression of terroir. One of the things that is a dearly held belief by the Burgundians, and there are some who challenge this, by the way, but one of the notions that is dearly held is that the deeper the root system of a vine goes, the more likely it is to be able to clearly express the site characteristics where it's planted. There are, like I said, there are those who would challenge that statement. However, that is the belief of the Burgundians, and one of the things that Pierre says that they have noticed is that they get clearer expression of terroir since they introduced the what they call an herbimal, is or the grasses between the rows, and they also have noticed that they have a much better microbial life in the soil.
Et un autre effet de cet enherbement, ça a été de sur par exemple des années un peu humides ou qui finissent dans des conditions un peu difficiles. Ça a été de la concurrence de l'herbe sur la vigne a permis de raccourcir un peu le cycle végétatif et d'arriver à des maturités techniques plus complètes.
He's saying that one of the things that they're especially happy about is that it actually pumps the water. In difficult years, it actually pumps enough water so that it shortens the vegetative cycle enough where they arrive at a level of phenolic maturity, meaning that they can actually go out and pick sooner. And as we've talked about before in these seminars, is that you have to remember that most people believe, you know, the commonly held image is that a wine starts the date that it's harvest. Well, it's not really true. There's 9 months of viticulture that precede that date. And so much of the work, in fact, more and more and more of the emphasis in Burgundy is how do we get the best fruit? And so getting the best fruit sooner is a huge advantage because, again, as we've talked about here, waiting is a form of risk, either because of hail, predation, acts of God, you name it, rot. There are lots and lots of dangers to waiting, which is why so much Burgundy is unfortunately picked too soon, because people are saying, you know, my mortgage payment, my kids' tuition, my is all sitting out there in the vineyard, and I'm watching the weather report here every day saying, what do I do? It's not right, but I don't want to let it sit out there. And so anything that works to get maturity sooner is viewed as an exceptionally positive thing.
Donc on en arrive peut-être au vin.
Oui, je pense.
Donc les vendanges manuelles, évidemment. Donc là, le domaine vient de construire une nouvelle cuverie pour pouvoir optimiser un peu tous les nouvelles techniques, sans être dans des vins technologiques du tout, parce qu'on pense que le respect du millésime, le respect de la vinification un peu naturelle fait partie de notre travail, donc on ne va pas intervenir beaucoup.
Pierre correctly notes that we should probably tell you something about the wines eventually, rather than just how the grapes are grown. One sec, let me just translate what he said first, and I'll be happy to take your question. Basically, in terms of the wines themselves, is that they're trying to get the best quality fruit that they can, and to that end, they have in 2007 was the first year where they constructed a new cuverie, a new winery, or actually a vinification center. And he stresses, however, that it was merely to handle the fruit more gently. They're certainly not making technological wines, because what they want to do more than anything else is to respect the individual character of each vintage, as well as respect the character of each wine that they're making, so that, as you will see, that there are distinct differences between them. Yes, sir.
Your translations are wonderful, but could you ask Pierre to speak to the microphone? Okay. Those of us that speak French, you can follow me.
Il veut que tu parles dans le micro.
Ah, okay.
Yes.
How do they incorporate compost in vineyards that have cover crop grasses growing?
Est-ce que tu mets le compost avec vignoble en herbement?
Oui, on a depuis 10 ans, un peu plus, on a recours au compost biologique qui est fabriqué par une association qui regroupe à peu près 80 domaines bourguignons. Et c'est le seul apport organique qu'on importe. Quoi.
So, yes, they do. And there is an association of about 80 domains who use, and they contribute material, but they also use this one center where they know the compost is clean and controlled.
And
My question was, how do they incorporate it in the soil when they have the cover crop from grasses soil?
Tu mets le compost comment?
Alors, le problème justement dans ces vignes à un mètre avec nos tracteurs, c'est qu'on ne pouvait pas facilement distribuer. Donc, cette association a eu pour but de fabriquer le compost, mais aussi de le distribuer. Donc, en fin de compte, c'est des grosses machines à vendanger qui, une fois les vendanges finies, sont transformées en matériel pour répandre le compost.
OK. Voilà. So, essentially, what they do is that the same group that fabricates the compost also applies it. And what they use is a machine, apparently, I haven't seen this, so this is news to me as well, is that they have a machine that is similar to a manual or a mechanical picking machine that after the harvest is done, then they'll run this through and distribute the compost.
Just into the grass?
Yeah, yes. Dans les vignes qui sont conduites en labour, on va passer tout de suite derrière avec des charrues pour introduire. Mais dans les vignes en herbement, le compost va rester en surface et petit à petit va être incorporé dans le sol par les lombriques, par tout ça.
So, basically, two methods. One is that in the vineyards that they plow, they will then, right after the compost is applied, they'll come through with a plow. And that will incorporate it. In the where they don't do that, or it's entirely on grass, they will just let it sit on the surface, and slowly it becomes incorporated and broken down, either by the action of rain, insects, etc., etc.
On a un autre apport qui est un peu naturel, mais c'est les bois de taille qui ne sont pas brûlés comme on faisait à une époque, qui sont broyés avec un appareil qui va faire vraiment des morceaux de bois très petits, et ces morceaux de bois vont être incorporés dans le sol naturellement aussi. Quoi.
All right, so the ancient system in Burgundy is when you do your pruning, they have what looks like a wheelbarrow, but actually it is an old petroleum barrel that they have modified in two ways. They cut out the top and then leave the barrel open like this, and on the bottom they cut out something like this and they put a grill there, and they burn the cuttings, what they call the sarmal, and the ashes then fall into the vineyard, and as they move along the rows, then the ashes are spread around. Pierre is saying that in their case, they have stopped doing that, and they actually have a shredder, and that chops the sarmal, which are very, very fibrous, into little tiny pieces, and it's reincorporated that way into the soil. There was a question?
Yeah, on the plowing, do they plow just on the vine rows, or do they plow the row centers also?
Quand tu labores, c'est au centre des rangs ou entre les pieds?
Alors, dans les vignes qui ne sont pas enherbées, on laboure à 100% de la surface. Mm-hmm. Dans les vignes enherbées, on va labourer seulement sous les ceps, mm-hmm. à peu près sur la moitié de la surface, l'autre moitié étant enherbée. Quoi. Okay. Donc tondeuse sur l'herbe en moitié et laboure sous les ceps okay. pour l'autre moitié.
It's a little complicated, but in essence, the vineyards that are plowed have 100% of it. They have this system. There may be those winemakers that are more up to date on this than I am, but they basically have a system now where there is a laser that reads where the vines are, and it will actually go between the rows, and then when it senses, okay, there's a pied or a vine, it pulls back out, and you have to go quite slowly, and old vines in particular are not really set up because they didn't have the ways to have 100% straight rows. And so you see things when you're out there that look like that somebody had a little too much to drink when they were planting them. But also when they have the rows that are under grass, then they only plow the section underneath the vines rather than the middle of the rows. So they use, in a sense, a hybrid approach.
Et donc, dans la fabrication de ce compost, quand même, on peut préciser qu'il va rentrer, en plus des fumiers de vache ou de cheval qu'on va acheter, il va rentrer tous les résidus de la vinification, c'est-à-dire les pots, les pépins, les rafles, tout ça. Et tout ça, ça va être remis dans la vigne. Ce qui fait qu'en fin de compte, la seule chose qui est exportée réellement de la vigne, ça va être le jus qu'on va extraire à la vendange. Voilà. Donc, il ne manque pas grand-chose à la vigne, elle n'a pas besoin de... Donc, on met très peu de choses.
So, this is an interesting comment. He says that they actually have a few cows, and they, from time to time, will incorporate a bit of the manure into the vineyards. But more importantly than that, they take everything from the vinification. So this includes the seeds, the skins, stems, etc., etc., and return that to the vineyard. The point being that other than the juice itself each year, nothing is taken out of the vineyard that isn't put back. And as a consequence, the vineyards need very, very little to keep them in biological balance.
And Alan, did they do that vineyard by vineyard? So only those that came from the St. George would go back, or did they somehow homogenize that?
That's a good question.
Est-ce que tu mets, par exemple, le pommas de Les Saint-Georges dans Les Saint-Georges ou c'est pas d'accord?
Non. Ce serait trop compliqué. Non, en fin de compte, on apporte le compost une fois tous les trois ans sur le tiers du domaine. Et on tourne comme ça.
Yeah. So, in essence, no, it's that's too complicated.
Peut-être deux mots, comment tu fais le vin?
Okay.
Et puis, vous dégustez à la fin.
Okay. Donc, la vinification, elle se passe toujours assez classiquement dans des cuves qui ont commencé d'être achetées par notre grand-père, c'est-à-dire des cuves en béton, béton assez épais, qui sont fermées en haut et qui permettent des vinifications relativement confortables.
So, the vinification is done more or less classically. It's done in cement. Béton is reinforced concrete. That is...
Qu'est-ce que c'est assez épais? Un mètre?
Oh non, non.
Non.
10 centimètres.
Okay. So it's perhaps 8 inches thick, which holds heat relatively well, and they cover the tops.
Disons que l'inertie thermique du béton va éviter des montées en température trop vite, trop rapide. Et puis à l'inverse, quand la fermentation est terminée, l'inertie thermique, le béton est chaud, donc les cuves ne vont pas se refroidir trop vite. Donc on n'a pas besoin d'avoir recours à des pompes à chaleur ou à des choses trop techniques.
Okay. One of the reasons that they like the cement fermenters so much, and by the way, these date from the time of Henri Gouges. So they've been around for a long, long time. But what they very much like about them is that they climb very slowly in temperature, but the reverse is also true. They descend very, very slowly in temperature. So they are not obligated to control temperature unduly, especially with heat pumps, et cetera, et cetera. So they believe that it gives them a relatively gentle vinification, and also relative to wood fermenters, concrete is much, much easier to keep clean.
Donc les raisins ont été cueillis à la main, évidemment. Il y a eu un tri assez sévère, certaines fois, quand il faut vraiment enlever des choses qui sont, soit des raisins qui ne sont pas tout à fait assez mûrs, ou des problèmes de botrytis, ça arrive. Ensuite, égrappage total.
So, the harvest is done 100% manually. There's a triage, which is sorting, that is done. And Pierre underscores that they are very severe. Anything that is either not as ripe as it could be or should be, or is affected by botrytis or other disease, is rigorously eliminated. Then the fruit is destemmed 100%.
Donc ensuite, la durée de vinification, elle va dépendre un peu du type de millésime. On va essayer de laisser la nature un peu faire son travail avec les levures de l'année, les conditions climatiques de l'année, de température. Et par exemple, un millésime comme 97, la vinification s'est faite sur une semaine, alors que l'année suivante, c'était plutôt trois.
So there's no set recipe for how they come at this. 1997, for example, the vinification was over in a week, whereas the
c'est 2004 quoi. En 97, on a eu des choses très courtes parce qu'on a rentré des raisins, c'est chaud, et on n'a pas voulu. Semaines. Comment?
Pour les trois semaines, c'était.
Oh ben, les autres années, plus couramment, c'est plus souvent trois semaines qu'une semaine.
Quoi. Okay, so the average vinification is 3 weeks.
Mais on va essayer de ne pas trop intervenir. On va contrôler pour pas qu'il y ait des accidents de température, mais quand le sucre est fini, que le vin est fini, il n'y a pas beaucoup de raisons de faire continuer des choses technologiques. On préfère respecter le type du millésime jusqu'au bout.
Et tu bosses plutôt avec le pigeage,
oui.
Remontage, les deux?
Non, on va alterner, on va... plutôt commencer par des remontages au début, après il y aura des pigeages, et puis quand le vin est pratiquement fait, on va arrêter les pigeages, revenir un peu à des remontages pour avoir des choses qui ne soient pas trop brutales, pas trop d'extraction, parce qu'on a des vins qui sont naturellement déjà tanniques, donc on ne va pas trop travailler l'extraction. Et puis ensuite un pressoir pneumatique qui va travailler très doucement aussi.
So they use a combination of punch downs and pump overs, and it just depends on where they are in the fermentation cycle as to which technique they use. But he stresses that they essentially are not trying to overwork the raw material. And when the fermentation is essentially finished, they rack off and they have a pneumatic press. That they don't press too hard because they already have terroirs that are on the robust side, so they're not looking to add any more structure because the structure essentially comes naturally.
Donc ensuite, un élevage en fût dans les caves pendant 18 mois, très classiquement.
Et pour porter un chêne neuf?
Autour de 15% de bois neuf.
Okay. So they then basically rack in the barrel, and the élevage is done classically, meaning the raising of the wine. New wood runs about 15%.
Collage, filtration.
Jamais, non. Dans la plupart des cas, quand on peut éviter la filtration ou le collage, on évite. C'est-à-dire que ça doit faire peut-être 15 ans qu'on n'a pas filtré ni collé.
So, for the last 15 years, they have, one sec, I'll get to you. For the last 15 years, they have neither fined nor filtered their wine, and everything that they do during the élevage is designed to get them to a point where the wines fall brilliant, and therefore don't need either technique of intervention. Yes, ma'am. Well, Pierre mentioned that they destem 100%. In Burgundy, it used to be a lot more common than it is today. Relatively few domains use stems. Now, there are some that, for example, are very well known, Domaine Roumier and DRC. There are lots and lots of guys, though, that are starting to experiment with proportions. Stems fell out, I mean, just to fill in a little bit. Stems fell out of favor thanks to Henri Jaillet. And those of you that have come before have heard me talk about why Jaillet was so against the use of stems. I actually have had a debate with him about that. His argument is, or was, as he passed away a couple of years ago, that have you ever tasted a stem that you liked? Yeah, so the notion is that it brings nothing interesting to the wine. My rebuttal to Monsieur Jaillet was, do you eat salt? is no. I said, well, you know, a little bit of salt is actually makes the food more interesting. And I am someone who believes that in the right circumstances with the right terroir, you can vinify with a certain percentage of the stems and bring something more interesting. If I were in Pierre's position, though, I probably wouldn't use them because, again, he works with terroirs that are naturally robust. I'm not sure that I would be looking to add more structure to a terroir that already had plenty of it. There are lots of other things that using stems do, and this isn't the time to get into the technical aspects, but stems make it more difficult to arrive at just the right point of extraction because it brings another source of tannin and a different kind of tannin. You have to have a clientele that will accept more structured wines and wines that drink less well early. The other thing that it does, botrytis often attacks the stems or can be found on the stems. So you have to have a vintage that's ultra clean. So it's a long-winded way of saying that more people are experimenting with them. I think you're going to see more wines with them. But when I say experimenting with them, it tends to be something between 20 and 50%. 100% stems, even at DRC or Roumier, is relatively rare now. And I would say that the upper end, save for a few wines where the cuvée is extremely small, meaning a barrel and a half. And technically, that's extremely difficult to vinify. And so just for sheer volume's sake, those often, like for example, Christophe Roumier's Musigny, it makes a barrel and a half. That's all stems. One, because it's Musigny, but also because he has this very, very small quantity. But in general, I would say that 60% is about the upper limit that you see on average.
Peut-être ça vaut la peine d'expliquer ce qu'on a en termes de Chêne Carteau et de Poré Saint-Georges.
Donc le premier vin, Chêne Carteau, donc c'est un premier cru qui est complètement au sud de Nuit-Saint-Georges, qui est dans un coteau assez fort. C'est des parcelles qui ont été remises en vigne dans les années 50, et ça avait été abandonné au moment du phylloxéra. Donc il y a eu une période où c'était en forêt.
Pierre, I mean, basically we're going to get into the wines now so that you can actually taste something rather than listening to us tell you about what it might be to taste them. Enough virtual tasting, it's probably time for us to actually get on. So the very first wine is from Chêne Carteau, which you will find at the very far left end of your map. So it's at the southern end of the middle section up on the slope. And it is a very sloped vineyard. And one of the interesting things that he brings up is that because of all the difficulties that we discussed with phylloxera, many vineyards were abandoned. And the ones that were abandoned tended to be the ones that were the most difficult to work. It makes sense that if you were already not making any money, why kill yourself even more or work even harder to produce something that nobody wanted? It's difficult to believe with the prices that Great Burgundy sells for today that even up through the 50s, DRC still sold. I mean, this is incredible, but it's absolutely the truth. Even Latache was sold in bulk up through the middle 1950s. And Pierre says that this vineyard was not replanted until the 1950s. So it basically sat there, what they call en friche, which is scrub, sat there for 80 years, just perfectly happy. Yet today, you'll pay a fair penny to have something that no one wanted 50, 60 years ago.
On s'étend quoi avec Chêne Carteau comme vin?
Donc sa situation en haut de Saint-Georges et à côté de Vaucrin, pourrait laisser penser qu'on est dans le même style de vin, alors que c'est pas du tout ça. C'est des sols qui sont très graviers, très secs, très pas du tout d'argile, contrairement aux deux voisins, et qui pendant longtemps, là aujourd'hui la vigne elle a 50 ans, un peu plus, 60 même, on a des vins qui sont assez structurés, mais pendant très longtemps, c'était des vins qui étaient beaucoup plus fluides, beaucoup plus light, beaucoup plus... voilà, c'est surtout ça la différence.
So, this vineyard does not have the clay that Vauquelin, its neighbor, has, and even though it sits next to Vauquelin, and Vauquelin, as we'll talk about, is the linebacker of Neuilly-Saint-Georges. It's a bruiser. And so the proximity to a terroir, to a vineyard that naturally gives some of the biggest wines in Burgundy, you would expect that Chenin-Carteau would give you the same thing. But there's almost no clay there, and it tends to be gravel. And so you get a wine that is much finer and much lighter in style.
D'ailleurs, pendant longtemps, pendant peut-être 20 ans, c'est un vin qui a été vendu sous l'appellation Neuilly-Saint-Georges-Village parce qu'on pensait qu'il n'avait pas assez la structure pour mériter le grand cru. Le premier cru, pardon.
In fact, for most of the last 20 years, they put it into their village wine, because it was their point of view until the vines got to be sufficiently aged that it didn't really give premier cru quality. And so it's only with relatively low yields that you get a wine that's structured enough that they believe that it has the quality to be declared as a premier cru.
Je crois que c'est, oui. C'est les caractéristiques, je pense qu'il n'y a pas plus à trop à dire.
Ok, hein? Peut-être bonne monopole.
Alors, le deuxième vin, donc Claude Eporé. Donc là, on est dans des terres beaucoup plus classiques et beaucoup plus représentatives de Neuilly-Saint-Georges. Là, je pense qu'on est vraiment dans des choses du milieu de la gamme qui sont assez typées Neuilly-Saint-Georges, avec des vins qui naturellement sont assez fermes. Hein. On a des tanins qui apparaissent... quelquefois au bout de quelques mois d'élevage et qui sont normaux, on les connaît, on sait que tous les ans c'est comme ça et c'est quelle que soit la vinification, la terre parle dans des choses un peu fermes, un peu.
So this is one of those wonderful Alice in Wonderland Burgundian appellations, because if you look on the map, you won't see this vineyard. And it is only in the cadastres, which are the rough equivalent of the Burgundian real estate office, that if you were to go and look for this vineyard, would you find it? It is 3.5 hectares, so it is even more improbable that when you look at the map that you wouldn't see something that's 3.5 hectares. But if you look right in the middle of the middle section, you will see a vineyard called Les Poirets. It's directly to the right of Les Cailles. And Les Poirets, which is, as Pierre points out, probably got its name because a long, long time ago it was planted to pear trees. One of the things that most people don't know is that growing grapes was not only not very profitable, you couldn't earn a living doing it. And so most vignerons practiced what was called culture, which means they had a bit of everything. They had fruit trees, they had cattle, they had chickens, they had all kinds of things which enabled them to basically be self-sufficient. But this vineyard called Les Poirets, if you essentially divide it in half, take the northern part, in other words, the part to the right, that is Claude Eporé Saint-Georges. And Domaine Gouge has 100% of it, and it's the only place you're going to find it. Donc and it gives a style of wine, as he says, that is archetypical Neuilly-Saint-Georges. Plenty of body, plenty of structure, some muscle.
Donc c'est une grande parcelle pour la Bourgogne, puisqu'elle fait 3 hectares et demi.
So it's a huge parcel. There are at 3.5 hectares. There are plenty of domains that aren't 3.5 hectares in size total. So This confers enormous advantages. And we've talked in the past about how size matters. And in Burgundy, at least with the vinification of Pinot Noir, size matters a lot. So the ability to have a big parcel gives you lots of grapes that you can vinify exactly as they need to be. And also from a viticultural standpoint, it enables you to farm exactly the way you want to.
Peut-être quelques mots sur 2006.
Oui, alors donc 2006, c'était un hiver assez froid, qui dure un peu. La vigne se réveille fin avril.
So, we're talking a little bit about 2006. So, the winter was very, very cold. And
oui, la vigne va débourrer fin avril.
So things started in terms of the initial growth at the end of April.
On a ensuite une brusque élévation de la température. On a une période assez chaude qui va provoquer une pousse de la vigne assez, voire très très rapide.
So May was extremely warm, which got the vineyards off to a very very early start.
Le mois de juillet est très chaud, avec un début de veraison dans les derniers jours de juillet. Et puis, on a un mois d'août qui est beaucoup moins intéressant, humide, beaucoup plus frais.
And then July was extremely hot. It's what they call canicule in French, which is sort of the dog days. And you had a classic July that was very, very hot. But they expected to harvest in early... I should say harvest early, but towards, say, the 20th of August. But August turned cold and wet.
Donc là, après, on a heureusement le beau temps qui revient au 1er septembre, disons, et pour des vendanges au 22.
So,
donc c'est relativement précoce quand même. Right.
So, the vineyard, or the vintage then, was pushed back quite a bit, and the good weather came in the beginning of September, and they started harvesting the 22nd of September. This is interesting when you look at what has happened in Burgundy in terms of global warming. You've basically, in the last eight vintages, actually nine if we I think about it, from 2000 to 2008, nine vintages, and you essentially had two of them that weren't saved by September. Essentially 2000, 2001, 2002, 2004, 2006, 7, and 8 were all saved by very, very good Septembers. In fact, I remember talking to you about the 2002, where powerful rainstorms came right to the edge of the Mâconnais and stopped. And so the Burgundians will all wink at you and say that that pretty much proves that God loves his Burgundy. 2005 we've talked about as being one of the perhaps the greatest vintage since 1978. It's not the easiest vintage, but in time I believe that it will be one of the all-time great vintages. There's everything that it needs, except perhaps for patience, because it will be a very, very long-term vintage. The great 2005s, 50, 60, 70 years from now, will still be with us. So, any comments or questions about the first flight of wines?